This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Good morning and welcome to another edition of the Indie Media Show. My name's Alex, very pleased and excited to be with you. I've been out of the big chair here for quite some considerable time, so very keen to be here in the studio with you. And I'm joined by my illustrious co-host Zoe. Lovely to have you in the studio, Zoe. How are we?
Hello, Alex. I am fine. I wish it were still a little bit more sunny, but alas, we have more sprinkling.
We do indeed, but yeah, we're in the safe confines of the studio and it's nice and comfy and cosy in here. Hope you're nice and comfy and cosy at home, or if you're at work, well, commiserations. Listen to what will hopefully be an informative educational show for the next week. Just pretend that you're busy working. You know, have a serious look on your face. When your manager comes by, tap the keyboards or, you know, wield the hammer appropriately so that it looks like that you're earning them surplus value. But don't do any more than you need to for your boss today, and instead concentrate on the Indie Media Show here on RTRFM 92.1. The Sound Alternative. Plenty coming up on the show today. Inevitably, Zoe and I actually were just having a discussion beforehand about one dimension of the Indie Media Show. We pride ourselves on independent, non-corporate media coverage, news and views you won't see in the mainstream press. And there's some tension and contradiction there with the fact that we do tend to tail and respond to trends and dynamics within the mainstream media. And I suppose this particular case is no different, where, yes, we are going to be talking about the death of Queen Elizabeth II, with a particular focus on the reactions in British society. There's obviously many dimensions to this. There's the grief and trauma and legacy of pain of the colonial history of First Nations people. There's the atrocities that the Queen presided over in Kenya with the concentration camps and massacres of guerrilla fighters there, the Malaya emergency, the Queen's to this day unknown role in the coup d'etat against the Whitlam government in 1975, the Queen's acquiescence, if not direct complicity, with the atrocities by the Special Airborne Service and the Force Reconnaissance Unit in Northern Ireland, when lawyers, human rights activists, and other civilians were murdered by loyalist paramilitaries and by the British Armed Forces, as I say, with at least implied complicity by the Queen. Of course, you will read very little of any of this history in the mainstream press amid an unprecedented degree of hagiographic, you know, sycophantic coverage, which is, I'm sure, for any person of, not only any person of conscience, but any person with, you know, historical knowledge of what the Queen actually represents and what British imperial traditions represent, has been nauseating and historically ignorant, to say the least. So to cover some of the British reactions and some of the alternative reactions that have been suppressed by the mainstream media, we're going to be talking a little later to commentator, activist, lawyer and author David Renton. And also we're going to be talking to something of a brother in independent media of ours, brother in arms, if you like, Andy Payne, who's had some guest spots on the show in recent times when he's travelled over from Queensland. He's back in Brisbane now. And one of the things he's involved in is getting ready for a big protest against the Land Forces Arms Expo, happening at the Brisbane Convention and Exhibition Centre from October 4th to 6th. This is a showcase, an opportunity for military arms manufacturers around the world, some 700 different companies being represented there. You know, so it's like a fair to sell tractors or what have you. It's, you know, it's all a nice, genteel little gathering of these arms companies, as I say, selling their wares often to regimes that absolutely guilty of human rights atrocities, whether it's Saudi Arabia in Yemen or the Indonesians in West Papua. Australia's arms manufacturing industry is very much up to its necks in providing export licenses to those countries to carry on those atrocities against innocent people. And yet, this is an industry that is sold by the Australian government as well, you know the script, don't you? It's jobs, jobs, jobs. Cluster munitions are used to kill women and children, but it creates employment opportunities in Australia, so therefore we should support it. One of the more facile arguments, one of the more disgusting sort of arguments that we're all familiar with, and Andy is involved in the group trying to expose the warmongering, the profiteering, which I think is more important than ever at a time like this with rising tensions with China, Australia browbeating countries like the Solomon Islands to stay within the Western orbit and not accept Chinese economic aid. Australia is manifestly and transparently a belligerent nation, an aggressor nation in the region, not only supporting the war in Ukraine, but as I say, supporting the continuation of Australian dominance of the South Pacific region in its ongoing historical duties, as the Australian ruling class would see it, its ongoing historical duties to serve as the chief lieutenant of the United States in the South Pacific region. So many, many reasons to protest that upcoming arms expo, so we'll hear a little about all of that later on. So glad for you to join us.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice.
We pride ourselves on not tailing or following the dynamics of the mainstream media, but sometimes you can't avoid it, and sometimes we think it's useful to put forward a different perspective, sometimes a radically different perspective that you're not going to see in the mainstream media. And no truer is the case than in this particular situation with the passing of Queen Elizabeth II. I mean, it's worth covering in and of itself, mind you, clearly an extraordinary historical moment in all sorts of ways, with the ascension to the throne of King Charles III, all kinds of, you know, cultural aspects to it, historical aspects, political aspects, plenty to talk about. So I thought I'd catch up with, he's been a previous guest on the show, he's an activist, an author, a commentator. He's written quite extensively, actually, on theories of fascism, as well as other aspects of British politics as well. David Renton, who I had the opportunity to speak to yesterday, and I started by asking David how he'd reacted to the initial news of the Queen's death, as well as the level of sycophancy and obsequiousness in terms of the British media's coverage of her death.
Look, Alex, when the Queen died, I wasn't particularly sad, nor was I particularly enthusiastic. I felt quite neutral and indifferent about it, if I'm honest. You know, I'm 49 years old. She's been a part of all my life. She's been Queen well before I was born, so I wasn't less than great. You know, often when you look at the Queen, in some ways there's certain things about her personality which is attractive, certainly if you're going to compare the way she's presented to most of the politicians we have on the right these days, who like putting themselves forward, plainly got their snouts in the trough. You know, she comes over in lots of ways as a different sort of figure, and I didn't have any particular objection to her. The thing that's bugged me is just the way that it's been impossible to carry on living normally over the last 10 days or however long it is since she died. You know, everything is closed off. If you want to do football in Britain, no, you can't. All the football matches are cancelled, even like amateur matches, even training for amateur matches are cancelled. Bird watching is cancelled. Everything's cancelled. We're forced to be spending our whole day supposedly glued to the box watching all this coverage about her. And for the very large number of people in Britain who feel like me, who aren't at all enthusiastic about her replacement, Charles, and so on, there's no place for us in that coverage. You know, I live in London. We're a left-wing city. We always vote for the most left-wing option that's available. Something like 40, 45% of people in London are Republicans. But you'd have no sense of that over the last few days on TV, where it's just this constant barrage of messages telling us this has to be the most important thing in our lives and we have to feel a certain way. And it's a way which very large numbers of people, millions of people, don't feel, frankly.
It's much the same here in Australia, I can tell you, David, where it's been wall-to-wall 24-hour coverage by particularly the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, doffing the cap to the old British colonial masters, and also to the BBC, whose own coverage has been quite extraordinary in its persistence and its wall-to-wall nature, and also the hagiographic nature of the way they've covered the Queen. It's one thing, isn't it, David, that football matches are interrupted and so forth, and there's this a constant media coverage, but there's an even more sinister aspect to all of this, and you've spoken a little bit about this on social media, and I've been following the news as well. One dimension of this is the arrest of people staging perfectly peaceful protests, simply holding placards saying "Not in my king," not my king, and so forth. So a kind of a sinister aspect to, I think totalitarian is too strong a word, isn't it? But a kind of a dominant public discourse around how one is supposed to, almost mandated to feel about the Queen, and anyone who feels otherwise actually runs the risk of arrest even.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. I don't want to start with the sinister bit because I don't want to make it, I don't want to overdo it. I mean, I think the first point is actually just to an extent it's laughable the way in which all sorts of private businesses have been trying to attach themselves to promote themselves as somehow connected to this, whether it's, you know, condom machines which have been closed down for 5 days, you can't get them in honour of the Queen, gay saunas, saying that, you know, they're going to be giving complimentary drinks to people who go into the sauna at the same time as the funeral. But, you know, and it's just ridiculous. That wasn't her life. That wasn't the things which mattered to her at all. There's no connection. They're trying to create one. Where it's sort of bordering on the sinister is just the kind of ubiquity, the constant messaging. You know, one of the ways I often think about this is, and you used the word totalitarian. Again, I'm not saying this is how our lives are going to carry on beyond Monday, but you know, if you think about the old Eastern European dictatorships or wherever else, which always sort of put up as the kind of prime instance of political evil in our world, the truth was is that they stopped at a certain point. They turn around to their people and say, right, you're going to be presented with images about the regime and slogans, and they'll be on the municipal buildings, they'll be on parliament, they'll be on streets around those buildings, but they won't be everywhere. You'll have quite a large space of your life to just go on and be silent and kind of get away from it. And that's one of the things that's really different now. I mean, it is kind of, it's bizarre, it's strange, it's extraordinary, just walking across from one side of London to the other, because what's happened is all sorts of private companies which previously would be messaging, you know, buy this, whatever, watch that, they've given over all their advertising spaces to just these constant images of the Queen again and again and again. In terms of just the sheer volume of images sort of instructing us how to think and feel, there's far more than there would have been in a contemporary dictatorship in wherever in the 40s or 50s. So, again, I don't want to exaggerate and say that this is sinister, because let's hope that, you know, this is going to end in a day or so and that we'll get back to our ordinary lives. But for the moment, it's certainly pretty unpleasant.
I think that's a very pertinent set of observations, David. And one thing that strikes me, however, there's a contradiction at the heart of all this, it seems to me, that behind all the imposing imagery and the pomp and ceremony and the constant media coverage, it strikes me there's a kind of a fragility at the heart of the British state and indeed British society more generally, because the Queen's death comes in the context of an extraordinary series of historical events that have struck Britain in recent times. Obviously, Brexit and then COVID, this huge cost of living crisis, inflation at 10%, you know, the scandals of the Johnson administration now replaced by this unknown quantity in Liz Truss, you know, the prospect of the United Kingdom itself breaking apart with another referendum in Scotland on the cards. There's this sort of overwhelming sense, certainly looking at Britain from afar, of underlying fragility in the state of British society. And I wonder if that's partly what's going on with the media and the state actually propping up these aristocratic traditions, you know, at a time of weakness and fragility for the British state.
I know this isn't how people are going to be, and I'm sure this isn't how people feel about it right now, but I could well see that part of the crisis could go on to be the crown itself. You know, we've been habituated for such a long time to a certain style of doing the monarchy that's all about service, self-denial. You know, the most striking and interesting thing about the Queen is that none of us know the first thing about her. You could put 100 British people in a room and say, tell me something the Queen said or did that was memorable. And between us, we couldn't come up with one thing, even if you had 100 of us there. The whole genius of the Queen as a kind of style of doing power was it was a complete abnegation, the self-denial. Now, very shortly, we're going to be faced with a completely different style of monarchy. We're already starting to see it, to do with the personality of Prince Charles. He's a very different sort of person who's much more trying to get cross, to be tetchy, to want to be at the centre of things, to need to be heard constantly, and in ways that, you know, I think relatively soon are going to feel quite alien and quite unlikable to millions and millions of people. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if the crown's part of that. But just on the broad picture, you're right. You know, going into the last few weeks, it's all kind of been put on hold by the Queen's by the Queen's death, but, you know, we were having strikes by almost every union of any size at all in Britain. We were having vast numbers of protests about the environment. There were, you know, getting on for 1 million people promising not to pay their fuel bills when they're due to increase at the start of October. And then the government, of course, is just on that last one, has tried to sort of deal with the issue temporarily by throwing lots of money at it. But the practical reality is that, you know, through October, November, December, we're seeing a cost of living crisis. We're going to be seeing a cost of living crisis in Britain, the likes of which we've never seen before. So, you know, you've got a country which feels like it's impoverishing itself at double fast rate, where all our institutions feel absolutely in crisis. And, you know, I wonder if this is maybe a way of thinking about it. You know, if you were going to look at the Soviet Union in 1950 or 1953, you'd say this was an incredibly successful society. Look what happened when Stalin died. All over the Eastern Bloc, people turned out in unimaginable numbers, this enormous outpouring of grief, 2 or 3 years later in exactly the same countries. The places which seem to be utterly pro that way of governing, whether that's Poland, Hungary, East Germany, all those places are now suddenly in ferment. Often the same people who turned out and mourned for Stalin just months and years later, saying, actually, we're angry about how things are going and we want it to change.
Yeah, and you've sort of partly answered the question already there, David, that there is, I suppose, from an optimistic point of view, certainly if you're on the left-wing side of politics, whether there's that underlying mood for Britain to head in another direction. Because one of the things about the media coverage, isn't it, is that it paints the picture that everybody is a fawning royalist, that everybody loved the Queen, that everybody, almost as a corollary to that, is therefore happy with the state of British society and the hierarchical institutions of ruling class of capitalist society. But that's not the case, is it? There is a mood for strike action and for collective resistance to, for instance, the cost of living crisis. So do you see, think it's a period of almost, as you say, stasis now, or of the battle not being fought for the moment, while the Queen is lying in state, but that will soon return to strike activity and forms of civil resistance, we hope.
Well, look, I think so. It's not just a matter of hoping. I think I'm being honest when I say that that's what will come next. One of the things that's worth grasping about Britain, and again, I don't particularly know if that's the same, Noz, but I kind of guess it is that we've had this really strange period under COVID, which is only just starting to recede into the immediate past, where for 2 years, people were dying in numbers which are completely unprecedented. We had something like 250,000 more deaths than we should have if it hadn't been for COVID, decided to just trickle down normally. And in all that time, no one was allowed to mourn. I'm certainly not alone. I had a close family member die in that period. What happened was that, you know, we couldn't go to do any sort of collective experience of mourning together. We had a church service that had 3 people at it, in our case. And that was, you know, for my dad, who, you know, many more than 3 of us loved him to bits. We just weren't allowed to do anything more than that. So we're a society that's been told for 2.5 years, you're not really allowed to mourn and to feel sorry for yourself. And I think that some of where the huge numbers come from, it isn't pro-Queen, it isn't anti-Queen, it's just a bunch of people who haven't had that chance to express how they feel. And suddenly, you know, society's turned on that tap and all that emotion just gushes out. It's attached to the Queen, but I think the connection to the Queen is relatively shallow, and the sense in which it then carries on to being any identification with Charles is almost non-existent. Already, you know, vast numbers of people in Britain are sharing stories and images about clearly what a tetchy and irascible and unlikable person he's going to be. So already I think you're seeing the kind of the germs of this new moment emerge, and that's even before we get on to all the things you talked about. The strikes, which have been put on hold, but they're still going to happen. The protests against global warming, which have been put on hold, but in 2 or 3 weeks going to start again. And this whole massive issue about inflation and the cost of living, which, you know, in lots of ways, Britain has been feeling like over the last couple of years, like we're going back into the 70s. And, you know, you can press pause and make that go away for a few days, but you can't change the fundamental reality, which is that people have a lot less money in their pockets than they did 3 months ago or 6 months ago or a year ago or 10 years ago. And everyone knows it. And the only way they can keep their costs of living intact is actually, to some extent, by engaging what are these forms of protest. etc.
David, we'll finish on the question of wherefore the monarchy itself. You've mentioned that King Charles III is, you know, he's got a lot of work to do in terms of making himself as popular as the Queen, because the Queen was a popular figure. There's no doubt about that. That's true here as well. And personality does matter in politics as much as we, you know, might like to think otherwise. The United Kingdom itself, as I said, is under threat, may not be long for this world, with Nicola Sturgeon wanting another referendum in Scotland, and who knows what might happen from there. So a bit of a cheeky question. Is the monarchy itself long for this world? And by extension, is the United Kingdom you're long for this world? How do you see things happening in the next few years?
Well, the pressures which are tearing apart the UK, it's very easy to see how they're going to continue now, how they're going to accentuate. You know, we keep on having in Scotland a party being elected with huge majorities whose central political plank is to achieve independence. In the next few weeks, the Supreme Court here is going to be facing yet another court case about, for example, whether they're allowed to hold a referendum if the English government refuses. And there comes a certain point at which just, anger with England, hostility against politicians down here, won't even let people have a proper vote, etc. At some point, that will create the conditions for you know, what actually will be a referendum, then the mother of a kind of political struggle about what do we do with people who no longer want to be part of the UK. You can freeze that to some extent, but it's been there, and you know, every rubbish Tory politician serves a politician we have in politics, and every new one that gets elected, the inevitability of that grows. So it's the UK, I think, that comes under institutional threat first. I think Charles isn't going to be as popular a figure as his mother was. It's very clear from, you know, all sorts of ways, even down to, you know, how this particular process has been arranged, that you know, the people panic, see that, understand that, and are constantly trying to come up ways to some extent of shielding him from public gaze in a way that they never had to do before. So I'm not going to predict now that, you know, you know, the monarchy will be gone in 10 years. But you know, we're already at a stage where London and Scotland, amongst the under-50s, you know, a Republican majority is going to be something that's going to happen anyway within the next year or two, in terms of majority people wanting to view that way. When it gets to majority in Britain, I don't know. But, it, you know, that could well be over a much shorter timescale than appear from the pictures that you see on your screens now.
Activist, commentator and author David Renton speaking to us about the British reactions to the death of the Queen. And just briefly, David touched on the decline in pro-monarchy sentiment among young people, and he also mentioned in Scotland. And what he argued about young people was borne out by a recent YouGov poll, which found that only 47% of 18 to 24-year-olds in Britain support the continuation of the monarchy, compared with a whopping 86% of Britons aged 65 and over. So a very clear, distinct generational divide there. And in fact, that support among young people has probably had a bit of a bump during this period, because back in May, just 33% had voiced their desire to keep the crown. And it's been progressively shifting towards a Republican sentiment among young people. As recently as 2015, 69% of 18 to 24-year-olds said that Britain should remain a monarchy. I don't have those figures in Scotland readily to hand, but you know, trust what David said there. And in Northern Ireland, it would be, you know, sort of a similar story, obviously, of division. So the point being that picture of uniform grieving and mourning and support for the monarchy that's coming through our TV screens is not an accurate representation of reality. And there is... I was going to use the word subterranean. It's not so much subterranean. It's kind of been forced underground for now, but definitely a rising trend of Republican sentiment, both here and in the United Kingdom. And Albanese, of course, said there'll be no Republic referendum in the first term. We'll see if he starts to shift his tone on that, you know, as we get closer to the next election.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
So we're going to go now to another interview with Andy Payne, who I said at the top of the show has been a guest on the show, and he's something of a champion, Andy. He's hosts what we would regard as a sister show over in Brisbane there on 4ZZZ, The Paradigm Shift. He does lots of great work, and he's also gets down and dirty with certain sort of activist campaigns as well. He's been involved in the frontline action against the coal campaign for a number of years, and one of the things he's also passionate about is ending ending Australian militarism and the Australian arms industry, which quietly, very much under the radar, is preparing for a big trade fair, the Land Forces Arm Expo, coming up in Brisbane next month. There's going to be a week of a festival of protests from 1st to the 7th of October, which we'll tell you about the details of that if you're over in Brisbane town next month. I want to head over there, get involved in the efforts to protest and disrupt this this arms fair, which is very much representing, you know, the merchants of death trying to increase their profitability and business with potentially selling to regimes and countries all throughout the world. And I started my interview with Andy just by asking basically, you know, the reasons for the protest.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes it's hard to figure it out just on that website. You have to dig through the layers of euphemisms and obfuscation to get to the fact that it's a weapons expo, actually, Land Forces. And so it is the biggest weapons expo in the Southern Hemisphere. Happens biannually, although it did happen last year in Brisbane as well because it had been put off because of COVID. But it basically is over 600 companies, some of the biggest weapons companies in the world, your BAE, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, ones like that. It's down to small contractors, PR firms that are trying to get a contract with some of these companies, everything along the trail of selling weapons. And there'll be plenty of governments as well coming. It talks about it being in the Asia Pacific region, but there'll surely be representatives from other nations as well and the militaries. And so basically Land Forces is a big trade fair for people that are in the business of making weapons and organising warfare. And of course, the other side of it is all the money that gets spent ultimately is our money from the taxpayers of the world. When the buyers are going to be governments in the long haul, it's us that's buying all these things as the bigwigs of these companies and some of the government and military people come and schmooze and do their sales pitches and all this. It's us that pays the price.
Now, in 2018, the then Morrison government released the Defence Export Strategy, and I quote from that strategic review where the government said, quote, "The Defence Export Strategy builds upon the Australian government's defence industry policy by setting out a comprehensive system to plan, guide and measure defence export outcomes. The government recognises that Australian industry cannot sustain itself," blah, blah, blah. It goes on with this kind of PR innocuous sounding jargon that we were talking about with the Land Forces Expo website as well. Anyway, it then goes on to say the strategic review that the aim is to, quote, "grow Australia's defence industry to become a top 10 global defence exporter." And indeed, the government was true to its word, because in 2019-20, the volume of Australian arms exports was $5 billion. And they're hoping to maintain it at $2.5 billion a year in exports around the world. Tell us a little bit, Andy, about, you know, some of the countries that Australia does sell arms to. I know that on your own show, you covered Australia's participation in war crimes in West Papua, for instance. Australia's up to its neck in criminal activity there. It also has sold arms to Saudi Arabia, who has besieged the people of Yemen and really starved to death many thousands of people in Yemen. So Australia doesn't exactly have clean hands in this industry, does it?
No, that's right. And it's one of those things, defence exports, is that politicians absolutely love it because they can talk about jobs, and I think it's, you know, the big toys, right, of the guns. It appeals to something very deeply rooted in our society, the love of the heroism of war. And so politicians absolutely love any announcement they can do around defence exports. But, yeah, I mean, one of the things is when we talk about what kind of jobs do we want, and what's the end result, like the making weapons is not the most productive thing that we could be doing with all the immense amount of skill and labour and time that people in Australia have. And so that's one side. The other side, as you say, is that, yeah, where do these weapons end up? And a lot of them end up being totally useless and just being a waste of huge amounts of money and energy, actually, as they sit in storehouses around the world not being used. But the ones that do get used is extremely problematic, as you say. And that's one of the things that we've been trying to highlight at Land Forces is where do these weapons end up? And there has been investigations that have found Saudi Arabia buying Australian-made arms to use in Yemen. Many civilians died in that war. Israel, you know, we have in Brisbane here, we've got company Elbit Systems, where in a few days we'll be doing a little protest there, you know, weapons used in the occupation of Palestine by Israel. And one of the big ones that we're talking about here is Indonesia's occupation of West Papua, which is ever expanding. And at the moment, they're trying to build a highway from one end of West Papua to another to basically open up a lot of these jungle areas for more exploitation, resource exploitation, more settlement of Indonesian people, and more moving West Papuan people off their land. And all this is enforced by the Indonesian military, to whom Australia offers strategic assistance, but also Australian companies sell weapons made in this country and in our city of Brisbane to Indonesia to be used in that occupation. And so that's, we'll have West Papuan speakers coming up to Land Forces to talk about what's happening there, and we'll be highlighting companies like Thales and Rheinmetall in particular, who have factories in Brisbane, who will have be on the showroom at Land Forces, and who are sending those weapons to be part of the dispossession of West Papuan people.
Now, of course, there are many, many reasons to join the protest at the Land Forces Expo next month in Brisbane. We'll give you the details of those protests, you know, to check out the website and get involved if you're in Brisbane town around that time. But, I mean, one dimension of this, Andy, I don't know how much, you know, you're across the detail of this aspect of things, is just the grotesque corruption involved. I mean, there's the weapons industry itself, which, as you say, is wasteful and you know, it's the most harmful, obviously destructive industry known to humanity, causes wars and death and suffering and the privations of millions of people. But there's also this element of corruption. For instance, we see this revolving door of politicians joining arms companies. So, for instance, former Liberal Defence Minister Christopher Pyne joined the board of arms company NIOA. Brendan Nelson, also a former Liberal Defence Minister, became the president of Boeing. Former Labor Senators Kate Lundy and David Feeney were board members of Electro Optic Systems. And former Labor leader Kim Beazley was on the board of Lockheed Martin at one point. So there's just that aspect as well. We're talking about, you know, billions and billions of dollars of taxpayers' money, and often it's sort of glad-handing and commissions and, you know, corrupt money being passed from, and you know, there's politicians going into the boardrooms of these arms companies. So it's sort of a grubby, dirty, you know, corrupt industry on top of everything else, isn't it?
Yeah, we're really trying to highlight that. Last year at Land Forces, we saw both Christopher Pyne and Brendan Nelson there. And whenever, you know, we had a presence there, whenever we saw them walking in, we'd make sure to point out, you know, that they shouldn't have been there, that, you know, you're elected as a politician and appointed as a minister to represent the interests of Australian people. And then you walk straight out of that job and onto a cushy board position at an arms company who were previously, you know, selling you products. You were their customer. It's very clear that they haven't been entirely there for the interests of Australian people. And it's a very serious problem, not just with politicians, but with some of the top brass in the military as well, moving into these positions in these arms companies. And it's just something that's, you know, endemic in Australia, in other industries as well, but in the defence industry. And it should just be completely stopped. It'd be very easy to wipe it out, say that you can't move from a position of public responsibility into a private realm of the conflict of interest. But this is what makes our political system go around, you know, these kind of revolving doors and mate deals and things like that. And so, Yeah, we're trying to highlight that as well.
I think the fact that it's not, it barely goes even mentioned in the mainstream press, it's just kind of thought of as normal. It's not even seen as corruption, which I think tells us a lot about the degradation of our public culture, that it's, oh, well, that's just normal. They're getting quote, a job in the private sector. In the private sector, of course, it's no normal job. It's a job where you use your political influence to, you know, to get contracts for that company. It's a disgusting business. Andy, we'll finish on this note, which is the protest itself. I mean, it's, you know, obviously we've had 2 years of COVID and there is real crackdowns on protests during that period. We could cite a number of examples, and it's one of those protests where I'm sure the police, let's say, aren't necessarily going to be friendly to any attempts to, you know, to blockade this this conference and the participants from getting in there and making these grubby deals with arms contractors. How are you anticipating, or in terms of the police response and how the protest is going to go?
Yeah, well, last year I think we caught the police a bit by surprise. We had quite a large presence, and we managed to get through, you know, all these places that are getting defence and security contracts. We managed to infiltrate the thing a few times, and we had people jumping up on tops of tanks with banners inside on the display room and things like that, as well as a presence outside. And so we really claimed that as a victory last time, that we had just completely dominated the media coverage around land forces and had really stopped their attempts to just have this, you know, private schmooze. And instead, we got it, all the news was about protests and things like that. And so we'll hope to do something like that again. I'm sure there'll be a bit more, the police will be a bit more ready for us this time. But yeah, we want to make it as unpleasant and as difficult to organise land forces as we can, and just make it, you know, a lot of public money from the Queensland State Government goes into this event happening in Queensland, and we think that we can possibly make it difficult enough to organise so that they just think it's not worth it. And so that's sort of our strategy. And so there'll be lots of ways that we'll try to do that. We'll have a presence there, and we'll have a few surprises in store for them, hopefully, and maybe stopping a few things loading in. But also, it's really important to gather together. Those of us who are interested in peace, gather together, share skills, have a community of resistance while we're there, and you know, try to work out how we can organise to resist militarism and organise for a better world.
That was Andy Payne, one of the organisers of the week-long festival/protest. There's a whole series of you know, live music performances and film nights and sort of educational sessions there surrounding the protest. So the actual Land Forces Arms Trade Fair Expo, Merchants of Death, whatever you want to call it, it's happening from the 4th to 6th. The protest happening over a longer time frame, from the 1st of October to the 7th. And if you want to get involved or just learn more about what Land Force is all about and the surrounding protests, you can go to, because it's the protest happening under the slogan Wage Peace Not War, so you can go to the website wagepeaceau.org. That's wagepeace, P-E-A-C-E-A-U.org. Or disruptlandforces.org, all one word, disruptlandforces.org.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out.
Time now for a little bit of news. And one of the things that's making the rounds in the industrial relations field, and by the way, we've been meaning to cover some of the uptick in industrial activity of late. We spoke to Nick Reamer on the show about the Sydney University strike. There's also the rail strike in Sydney, the nurses' strike. Public sector workers happening with the activity over here is also plenty happening. And one thing the government is doing to try and assuage some of that rising militancy and anger in the working class is to improve industrial relations legislation. They've already, and one has to, you know, give credit where it's due. This is a good, positive step forward by the Albanese government. They've said they will bring forward legislation to the federal parliament that will allow multi-employer bargaining. So it's not quite the old patent bargaining of the 1980s. And just to explain briefly, for those who perhaps don't know what I'm talking about, aren't familiar with the terminology, enterprise bargaining refers to the bargaining of a workforce with a single employer to establish, you know, wages and conditions for the life of that agreement. The old pattern bargaining was industry-wide bargaining, where a workforce would go on strike, perhaps in conjunction with another group of workers or multiple groups of workers in that industry, in order to establish a bargain, wages and conditions agreed to by multiple employers across the entire industry. What the Labor government is proposing now is multi-employer bargaining, so somewhere in between enterprise bargaining and patent bargaining. And also in IR news, there has a talk of new legislation protecting the rights, or establishing the rights is probably the better way of putting it, of so-called gig economy workers. These are people who are notoriously categorised legally as independent contractors, so they're denied the rights to sick leave and overtime pay and superannuation and so forth, under what is, you know, essentially a legal fiction, because everybody sort of knows that Uber is obviously the employer of share ride drivers, you know, and so forth, that they in every way, shape or form, from a logical point of view, constitute an employer. So legislation to actually make it a formal employment arrangement, which are therefore, you know, well, it's already subject to rulings in the Fair Work Commission, but be more streamlined, if you like, within the IR system, where gig workers, you know, would have a firmer legal footing to establish sick leave and annual leave at superannuation, etc. So that hopefully legislation that will be happening soon. And just worth briefly mentioning as well, the crisis continuing in Pakistan. A third of the country is underwater. The Australian government has contributed $2 million to relieve the enormous crisis there. Millions of people left homeless. Obviously, the danger of waterborne diseases, people trying to return to their jobs and businesses and unable to do so because of the continuing flooding. $2 million by the Australian government, and UN agencies have called for a substantial increase in that amount. And it's worth mentioning as well that the political backdrop to those floods is the Pakistani government itself has called for reparations, that have used the word, or climate justice. So this is something that we're going to see more and more in the news with these sorts of disasters. Whether or not we can directly attribute them to anthropogenic global warming is, you know, something for climatologists to determine. But broadly speaking, I think here at the India Media Show, we'd support that argument for reparations for you know, forms of climate injustice that tend to hit the global south, or what we used to call the third world, much harder, even though those countries historically are, of course, not responsible, or are responsible for only a fraction of greenhouse gas emissions historically. In the United States, there was the prospect of a nationwide railroad strike, which has been averted now. This is a last-minute deal to avert that strike. Would have been very interesting, I suspect. I mean, in this sort of wider context of a bit of an uptick in industrial militancy from the working class that I mentioned, yet to see... Well, I take that back. I was going to say, yet to see that in the United States. We have seen some seeds of it with UPS workers, with Amazon, attempts to unionise Amazon warehouses. You know, the fight to increase the minimum wage is an ongoing campaign in the United States. So very much little spot fires breaking out, you know, in the heart of the beast in the United States. But I think this potential railway strike, which has now been called off for the time being, would have had the potential to be a real sea change moment. Similar to the UPS strike in 97, yeah, we can go further back to the famous airline pilot strike of 1981 that was crushed by the Reagan government. It was seen as a turning point in terms of the defeats of the union movement in the United States. And indeed, the union movement really has never recovered from that period of defeat in the early 1980s. But it's something worth watching. And interesting as well that it's railway workers kind of leading the charge. They've been on strike repeatedly in recent months in London, on the London Underground, and in Sydney as well. So sort of an interesting side note to that story, I guess, that, yeah, let's all follow the railway workers to victory, to better times, I would say. So that's all happening. And I just... as a bit of a final rejoinder, if you like, to our coverage of the Queen, something I actually posted on Facebook, which is, you know, not something I do very much of, but I just wanted to actually, felt it would have been remiss of me not to give this quote in full, talking about the passing of the Queen and a First Nations perspective. I thought Victorian's Grand Senator Lydia Thorpe summed it up brilliantly. I just thought it was, yeah, the most brilliant thing I've read anywhere in terms of a statement in response to the death of the Queen, where she said, and I quote, It is insulting that the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has called the 22nd of September public holiday a national day of mourning for Her Majesty the Queen, when First Nations people have called for 26th of January to be acknowledged as a day of mourning since 1938. We called for a day of mourning so that this country could understand how we're still affected by colonisation today. We're not grieving a singular human life. We're reeling from the violence that is the legacy of the monarchy.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.